Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Rachman Review. I'm Gideon Rachman, Chief Foreign Affairs Commentator, a role that often takes me abroad for conversations with some of the people, diplomats, policymakers, writers, who are shaping the global debate. As a columnist, most of my discussions are off the record and then used as background for my articles. With this show, however, I'll be getting more of my contacts to go on the record so that listeners and subscribers can join the conversation.
Mr. Trump, you are a liar, you are a fraud, and the American people are not going to re-elect you.
Frankly, I'd rather run against Bloomberg than Bernie Sanders, because Sanders has real followers. Bloomberg's just buying his way in.
I'm here to tell you how deeply committed I am serving as your partner in the White House. But first, I need your help to get to the White House.
There's some people who don't like this. Actually, let's be more specific. There are some billionaires who don't like this. Some have gone on TV and cried. Others have run for president.
Don't forget, when he first ran, I called him 1% Joe, because every time he ran...
This week's edition is about the U.S. presidential election, and in particular, the struggle for the Democratic Party nomination.
I think we're going to have a very interesting Democrat race. And I think we're going to have a very interesting election.
I'm joined here in the studio by two Americans in temporary exile in London. Miriam Estrin is a former State Department official who currently works for Google, but is speaking here in a strictly personal capacity. And Jeremy Shapiro is another former State Department official who is head of research for the European Council on Foreign Relations. Miriam, normally after the first two primaries, Iowa, New Hampshire, we have some idea of who the front runner is, but it doesn't feel like that this time.
Yeah, that's right. And probably because not many of them have dropped out yet. And we are still in the very early phases of the primary campaign. You know, as Joe Biden is quick to point out, we right now only have 1.6% of the total delegates awarded. And we won't see a large share of delegates awarded until after the Super Tuesday contest, which comes in early March. That's when you'll get up to 40% of the delegates awarded. And that's the point when you start to see, I think, candidates really winnow down.
Jeremy, though, do you think, I mean, Sanders won New Hampshire. He's the one who seems to have a bit of momentum right now. And yet the media still seem to find it hard to imagine that he'll get the actual Democratic Party nomination. Do you think we're in danger of underestimating him in the way that we maybe underestimated Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think there's some possibility of that. I mean, I'm certainly not willing to predict a Sanders victory, but I'm not willing to predict an anybody victory at this point. I think one of the things that you notice about the Democratic primary calendar, the way that it works, is that once you get a lead, it's going to be very, very hard for anyone to catch up. So if Sanders is able to take the momentum that he has right now into these very, very delicate, heavy primary contests on March 3rd and on March 10th, and he emerges roughly where he is now, he'll be almost impossible to catch, which is essentially the story that Trump did in 2016. So yeah, he can definitely win the nomination. Another thing to note is that there's a big change in the primary rules this year, which is that the 775 so-called superdelegates don't get a vote in the first ballot. There has to be a brokered convention or nobody has to have a majority in order for them to vote. Those people are generally dead set against Bernie Sanders, but they won't matter, at least in the first round of voting this time.
And I suppose, Miriam, that one of Sanders's possible advantages is that he now seems to be the front runner for the left of the party, well ahead of Elizabeth Warren, whereas the battle to be the moderate is still split between Biden, Buttigieg, and Bloomberg coming in. And Klobuchar, of course, I shouldn't forget her. So that's four. So do you have any sense of which of those could emerge? And do you think Bloomberg might actually, with this highly unconventional, money-heavy campaign, could it work?
It does appear to be going all right for him. You know, the trouble with a Bloomberg run like this is we've never seen it before. So nobody kind of knows where to look to assess whether it's a winning strategy to skip the first four contests and come in heavy on Super Tuesday. But I think it's also important to note that Sanders isn't running away with large supermajority shares of the delegates in these early contests either. So when you go into Super Tuesday and you still have five candidates running, you could imagine them splitting the vote a few ways. And I know we've talked about the very unlikelihood of a brokered convention. It's never happened before. You know, Jeremy and I chatted before. He thinks it's not going to happen.
This is a convention where there's nobody with a majority. And so it all gets frightfully exciting. And they decide actually at the convention and people
right.
start switching. And
right.
So
maybe someone has a plurality, but they don't have the majority. And so it's not clear first off who's going to run away with it. And it looks like a brokered convention isn't the likeliest outcome, but it's not a mathematical impossibility.
Yeah. Bloomberg is unconventional, as Miriam says, in the nature of the campaign that he's running, skipping the early contest, in the huge amount of money that he's pouring into it, just drowning everybody else. Also, do you think he is, Jeremy, so far to the right of where the rest of the Democratic Party is that it could be hard for him, or is he a conventional Democrat?
I have no idea where the Democratic Party is. I know that all of the candidates have moved a bit left, particularly on domestic issues, which is an indication that they think that that's where the Democratic electorate is. But I think a better way of really understanding it is that they're reacting to Trump. You know, Trump is really the issue in this election. On a certain level, he's the only issue. And what all the candidates need to do to excite the Democratic base and to get votes in the Democratic primaries is to articulate why they are different and better and not Trump. And that they can beat Trump. This is actually the argument that all of them are making. The policy arguments that they're having are actually, I think, sort of proxies for that point. And so, you know, the question to me is not, is Bloomberg too right or too left, but how does he distinguish himself from Trump? And I think he's probably able to do that, despite being another New York billionaire, which is, you know, admittedly a problem, by demonstrating that he actually knows how to govern, that he has some technocratic solutions, that he is a calmer person, that he is actually rich as opposed to Trump, that he's not in it to make money, he's in it to spend money. And I think it's quite fascinating to see the distinct approach. Trump seems like a rich guy who's using the presidency to get richer. Bloomberg seems like an even richer guy who wants to spend his money on the presidency.
And just a footnote, but it is kind of amusing, isn't it, that Trump actually got himself impeached trying to gather dirt on Joe Biden, whose campaign then went absolutely nowhere, as far as we can tell.
Yeah, he's been waiting since 1988, I think. it is quite extraordinary to notice that Biden, this is his third presidential run, where early on he has never won a primary. Not a single one.
That's not a good omen, is it?
Well, and it's interesting because he's the one, of course, who's been making the biggest case for himself that he's the electable one. Don't pay any attention to Iowa, New Hampshire. When it comes to South Carolina, you'll see later on Kentucky, I'm the one who can win. So his whole campaign has been based on this notion that he's the electable one and that he will bring this restoration of the Obama administration back to the fore.
I suppose the one thing that he could argue and that others would argue is that so far we haven't had African-Americans voting very heavily in Democratic primaries, and they're a key part of the base. And Sanders has been weak with that constituency in the past. Buttigieg seems to have a problem with them as well. How do you think that will change the contest?
Yeah, well, we have two contests coming up. One, the Nevada caucus, which is this weekend, and then next, South Carolina. And the Nevada caucus is a place where Sanders thinks he can do particularly well with minorities by getting a lot of the Latino vote. And then South Carolina, as you said, is a bigger test for the African-American vote. And that's where I think Joe Biden feels like it's his most important stand. He calls it the firewall. And where it looks like some of that vote is peeling away towards Bloomberg, actually. But I do think it is a challenge for Sanders, and it is one he acknowledges and has to take up.
Yeah, and we haven't really discussed Buttigieg yet, Jeremy, and yet it's an extraordinary candidacy, isn't it? And because A, he's so young, B, he's a mayor of just a small town, and of course he's gay and married to a man, which would be the first time that you had a man married to a man as the president.
Yeah, the whole thing is quite extraordinary. I mean, I'm completely confused by his candidacy. But at the same time, when you look at him and when you listen to him, what you hear is somebody who is enormously talented. I mean, you can hear it in his voice, in the way that he approaches questions, in the sort of calm manner which through which he dissects problems. He's reassuring. He's intelligent. He's very not Trump. And he's very analytical, yet in a folksy, in-touch way. He's a pure natural talent. A different one than Obama, but in the same mold of someone who you can just see them be president. It's quite extraordinary at 38 years of age. But I think what we also maybe should have learned from the Obama and the Trump elections is that we have no idea what is electable in America these days. There has been such a sweeping change in the way that people appreciate and understand, for example, gay people in the United States just over the last 10 years. The Democrats actually lost the 2004 election on the issue of gay marriage, but now it doesn't seem to matter at all. And now you can't even have a television program on primetime in the United States without gay characters.
And Miriam, I mean, just a last word on Sanders, since he does seem for the moment to be the front runner. He too would be an extraordinary candidate, wouldn't he, if he made it? A, he's old, he's just had a heart attack, but perhaps most important of all, he's a self-described socialist, which used to be regarded as completely anathema in the United States.
Yeah, I guess we're all sort of making variants of the claim that someone isn't electable based on some characteristic, whether it's, Warren can't make it because she's a woman, or Sanders can't make it because he's a socialist. And one way to look at that is to look at kind of the polling on what do Americans think about socialists or about women. Or what do they think their neighbors think about socialists or about women?
Well, you mean because that might be a more accurate gauge of what they think?
Well, so the one on women is quite interesting. So there was a poll over the summer that asked people those two questions, which is, would you vote for a woman to be the president of the United States? And do you think your neighbor would vote for a woman to be the president of the United States? And in the first category, 74% of, and it was for Democrats and independents, they said, yes, of course, we would vote for a woman. But they thought only 33% of their neighbors would.
Right.
Okay, so what's happening there? So either it's the case that there are a lot more sexist people who are afraid to admit that to pollsters, or it's the case that there is a massive perception gap in what we think people will vote for versus who they will actually vote for. And so I think this gets to a point, you know, Jeremy was making, that we don't really have a good sense of who it is that will capture the imagination of the American people.
And Jeremy, I mean, coming back to the point we were discussing earlier, that this is all about who can beat Trump, do you think that given how polarized the American electorate is, almost anyone the Democrats select, certainly of the ones we've discussed, has a good shot at beating Trump?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Trump is in a pretty good position like any incumbent president would be, but he's in not as good a position as most incumbent presidents have been because he hasn't made any efforts to expand his base as president, and he has a very narrow path to election. And when you see in the generic polls, he loses to the generic Democrat every time. When you name candidates, the contest gets a little bit closer, but it's close with all of them. And in general, he's losing in the national polls. He's almost guaranteed to lose the popular vote. And it's very close in a few swing states that will make the difference. But there's a path to victory, I think, for any of the candidates that we're talking about. The most important thing, clearly, is not to, in the general election, is not to convince anyone of anything. We already basically know how everybody in America is going to vote in the general election. What we don't know is who's going to turn out to vote, and whose votes will be counted.
When you say whose votes will be counted, what do you mean by that?
I mean that there's a big, principally Republican effort at voter suppression through disincentivizing people for voting, through creating greater voter identification demands, through confusing the electorate about, you know, things like when the voting is and that type of thing that is, you know, having an effect in some states. And so it's a little bit unclear as to how effective that is or how effective it will be, but it's an issue. And so one of the things that any Democratic candidate will have to do is really focus very hard on informing his electorate about voting and getting them out to the polls and making sure that they have everything they need in order for their vote to be counted, and that he has lawyers to make sure that their vote is counted. So that's actually a huge organizational and legal task that any Democratic candidate will have to take on. And I think it emphasizes that what we're really looking for in a general election candidate from a Democratic perspective is somebody who can create enthusiasm on his side, create a lack of enthusiasm on the other side, and make sure that he has the right strategy to get people to the polls and to make sure that their votes are counted. None of that is really about ideology or electability or even party unity. It's more about making sure that you get people to the polls.
Yeah, Miriam, do you accept the kind of underlying argument there in Jeremy's thing that ideology doesn't really matter? Because I think that a lot of the outside observers, and certainly Republicans that I've spoken to, think that if the Democrats pick a very left-wing candidate or a candidate who goes very heavy on identity politics, however defined, that will play into Trump's hands by alienating the middle class, particularly the white middle class.
Yeah, there does seem to be a sort of sense of glee among the Republicans at the prospect of a Sanders Democratic nominee. But I guess I do agree with Jeremy that people vote more on those kind of ineffable qualities, those impressionistic qualities of, do they like this guy or not? You know, do you have it or don't you? And, you know, on the question of can a socialist win in particular, Gallup ran a poll, I think, earlier this month that asked Democrats, would they vote for a socialist? And 76% said yes. I think the reason to be concerned about Trump re-election is based on the kind of fundamentals of campaign election theory. So a lot of what we've been discussing today is about the kind of traits of a candidate. But there is a theory that actually the thing that matters most in determining the outcome of a victor in the election is the fundamentals. And the fundamentals are this: is the economy doing well? And do the American people support your handling of the economy? And two, are we currently in the middle of the Vietnam War and is it going really badly? And, you know, if your answer to number one is yes and your answer to number two is no, then by and large, that president wins the election. And so what do we know about Trump? We know that as of the latest poll, a whopping 63% of Americans approve of his handling of the economy, and we are not in the middle of the Vietnam War. And by the way, that 63% is apparently the highest approval rating for any president's handling of the economy in the last 20 years. So that, I think, is a figure that is worrying. And so I think it does give voters a reason to have some pause, particularly when you have a candidate like Sanders, who, if he is the nominee, would be running on a campaign of radically restructuring the economy. And so that does, I think, feel incongruous to some voters to have 63% of Americans supporting the direction the economy is going with a candidate who wants to see a massive restructuring. And I think to overcome that, you'd have to find that voters were actually really motivated by the things Sanders talking about, that they don't feel that the economy is working for them. They do want to stick it to the billionaires. They want a higher minimum wage, better Social Security, loan forgiveness, and all the rest. So I think that's kind of what we're up against.
Yeah. And Jeremy, just to end on that point, Trump still seems like an extraordinary president 3 years in the sense of the way his gleeful violation of all normal conventions of how a president behaves. How much do you think that weighs on his prospects of re-election? Are Americans concerned by it, or do they maybe be a bit concerned by it, but they're happy with the economy and therefore they'll discount it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they are concerned about it, but we know who they are. I mean, they're the sort of anti-Trump voters. I think Miriam is really right to point to the fundamentals and to show what advantage they give to Donald Trump. And I think that that's, you know, why he will probably be reelected. But I think that the reason that he's vulnerable at all is because he hasn't attempted to expand his base. He hasn't attempted to use those good economic numbers to convince anybody that he is a sort of leader for them, anybody who didn't vote for him in the first place. And so he's created a very polarized electorate where 45% of the people say that they like him and they'll accept anything from him. And about 49% say they hate him and will never give him credit for the economy. And then there's this very small middle in just 7 or 8 states that matter for the election. That's why it's such a sort of contained story, the general election. And it's why it's close at all, because he has decided not to be a normal president in any way and expand his base. So I guess we'll have to see. I think presidents usually get reelected. They especially get reelected in a good economy, but Trump is testing that theory perhaps to destruction.
Okay. Well, I'll just end by asking you both unfair, short questions. If you had to say now, Miriam, who do you think the Democratic nominee will be, and do you think Trump will win?
I have no idea. But, you know, I am someone who also had a grandpa named Bernie from Brooklyn. So I'm going to go Bernie Sanders as the nominee, and I'll give him the election.
Jeremy, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I also have no idea, but I've learned in the think tank business that the key is false precision.
Right.
So I will say that Bloomberg has the highest chance of winning the Democratic primary with a 37.8% probability, and that Trump will win the general election with a 53.2% probability, which is pretty low for an incumbent president.
Okay, well, with that very impressive precision, thank you very much indeed to Jeremy Shapiro and to Miriam Mestrin. That's it for this week. I hope you'll be able to join us next week. And remember, if you don't yet subscribe to the podcast, you can do so on any podcast app. Just follow the link at ft.com/Rachman Review.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.